my name is Charles, and I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic. Hi. It is by the grace of a loving God and the fellowship of this program that I have been clean and sober since March 24th of 1981, and I am truly grateful. It really is an honor and a pleasure to me to be here tonight to introduce Marie. She has become more than just friends to me. She has become closer to me than my real blood family relationship. I met Marie, had the pleasure of hearing her talk several times in my first year of sobriety, just barely got acquainted with her in that year. In my second year, got more involved a little socially, and we became strong friends, and the friendship just grew and grew and grew into familyship, and I absolutely adore Marie. And it is so thrilling for me now to be here in my new home, Dallas, which all came about because 3 years ago, at your first gay roundup on this weekend, when I came with Jack with Riley to your first roundup and fell in love with all of you Lambda people and fell in love with the beautiful city of Dallas, came back the second year, reinforced that love, and now within the third year have moved lock, stock, and barrel, and this is home. And it's just a thrilling pleasure for me to introduce my dear friend, who I love very much, Marie.
Take a minute to get this right. I hope old habits don't get in the way. My name's Marie, and I'm an alcoholic. And I gave Charles my speaker badge because he was so nervous. I told him, I said, well, here, darling, this will just make it official, because he was real nervous. And I'm not. I'm not. But you know what I do need? I need a watch. Thank you. Okay. I'm real glad to be here. I'm here to tell you a little bit about what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm trying to be like today. This is not the first time I've been to Texas. I was a guest of the Texas State Convention several years ago. And for those of you who were there when I visited with my husband may find it surprising I'm here. However, they tell me that in Alcoholics Anonymous that if I abandon myself to this program, that great events shall come to pass for me and countless others. And and I'm just tickled to death that the conspiracy of love that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous brought me here, because God, I wanted to wear this dress somewhere. <I did. laughs> And that's one of the wonderful things. I've already, several people have asked me, could they borrow it? And I thought possibly the jacket would fit any males over 6 foot. It does. Anyway, I am here to talk a little bit about my alcoholism. And I've got it. There's just no doubt about it. I was just enthralled by what you read. That was absolutely wonderful, the different things from the big book intertwined in there. And the fact that we do have a way out on which we can absolutely agree in harmony. You know, when I was about 9 years sober, by the way, by the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have not found it necessary to take a fixed pill or drink since either January, February, or March of 1970, I think, two. And for that, I'll be eternally grateful. I have to tell you, when I spoke at the Texas State, and when you hear my story, you'll know why I don't know when I got sober. I'm just, if I had, If I had known I was going to stay sober, I would have paid attention, but I never had before, so I didn't pay any attention. You know? And that's, you know, I have a friend named Peter Nava in Los Angeles that insisted that I pick a date, so we celebrate March 1st, but don't have any idea. When I was, I think when I spoke at the Texas State, I was like 6 years or something, I'm not sure. And I just marveled at the newcomers that had the brain to remember all that by the grace of God and the fellowship of God. I wouldn't have been able to do it. I mean, it was like my name, and then I was stuck when I was new because something had happened to my brain, and I could no longer retain things. But I'm glad I remembered that. I was born in, I was born in Georgia and was stuck in Oklahoma. And I have to tell you that, and I've said it, when, and no matter where I speak, that I believe being from the South is a whole nother disease. And I also have to tell you that my favorite places to come in Alcoholics Anonymous and share is the South, because people are so wonderful and gracious and loving and warm. However, I was born in the South, and I was born into an alcoholic family. My mother is alcoholic. My Aunt Jo died of this disease when I was 2 years sober. My grandfather died of this disease. My whole family is riddled with the disease of alcoholism. And I was never going to be alcoholic. I also need to tell you that no one in my family hit the bottom I did. My mother hit her home in a $300,000 home. No one ever lived the way I did. But when I was a small child, I somehow sensed that alcohol took from me everything I felt was emotionally mine. There was nobody home in my house. I thought I was ugly, and if you're from the South, you know. Now, this is real important because it's genuinely affected my life, and it was one of the reasons I had to have an answer. If you're from the South, you know that women are for breeding. I mean, it's just a simple fact, especially 36 years ago. Women were for breeding. It was very important that you grew up, and even if you went to college, the purpose of you going to college was to get a man so that you could be somebody. And it was also very important that you have blonde hair and wear pink lipstick and be demure. Now, I have never, other than being platinum at one moment of insanity last year, been blonde. I do not have a fondness towards pink lipstick, and God knows I've never been demure. I mean, I thought I was ugly, and I was taught values about sex, like if a man, now you have to listen closely to this one, okay? If a man could go to the library and check out a library book, there would be no reason for him to buy it, okay? That was my brother that laughed hysterically on the front row. It's a fact, though. So if a man could go to a library and check out a library book, he'd have no reason to buy it. Now, having been checked out at a very young age, I knew that nobody was ever going to buy me, and that proved not to be true later on in my life. I made a lot of money in Los Angeles, but at that time, I knew that my life was over. I hurt as far back as I could remember. I hurt over starving children in China. I just hurt. Life was not fun for me. It was over before it began. I am one of those people that was born old. I am younger today than I have ever been. I arrived at Alcoholics Anonymous 13 years ago, a 23-year-old, 76-year-old. The war was over and I had lost. And really, if the truth's known, that's the way it was when I was 7, 8, or 9. I just was never... I see being young as being carefree, and never in my life was I free of care. I get a little bit nauseated in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings when I hear people talk about how sensitive we are. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm sure you have the same textbook here in Texas that we have in Los Angeles. However, I have a sneaking suspicion it may be used more here than there. However, the textbook talks about some of us are very sensitive. Also refers to it as a serious handicap that sometimes takes a long time to overcome. I don't know if alcoholics are more sensitive than other people. I do know this. I do know that we're much more self-obsessed about our feelings than they are. I mean, I remember laying up in the bed when I was 13 years old, and Elvis Presley came out with a very sick, sad, and sorry love song. It was called I Can't Help Falling in Love with You. And I mean, it's like real. And I used to lay up in the bed and sob over that song. And I had never had a boyfriend or a drink yet. I mean, I was just, that's the way I was. That's just the way I was. Now, you might get it that for some people, Alcoholics Anonymous was a step down. In my case, it was a step up because I desperately needed an answer. The first answer that came for me was that our house burned down and we got the hell out of Oklahoma. And I believe that my God knew that I would have never survived there. I believe that. Only because of what I had on myself. And how I completely thrown myself away as a human being, completely. We moved to California. It was wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful. We ended up in California, and they had whole cities out there of stuff that we didn't even talk about back home. I mean, all I could see was alternatives. I mean, there were people there that had been checked out, and not only were they not embarrassed, but they were looking to get checked out again and talked about it, you know? And I mean, it was people with all different colors of hair. I mean, my mind exploded with alternatives. And it was shortly thereafter that I took my medicine for the first time, and I say to you that it was medicine because I'm one of those. Some people slide into their alcoholism. I did not slide into my alcoholism. I fell off. I have never had a social drink in my life. I took my medicine. There's two real important things that happened in my life. I told you that I needed an answer. And the first answer I ever found was lying. And I mean, when I was a little kid, I just lied about everything. Everything. And it gave me freedom from me. I mean, I just could not accept this person as she was. And the other thing that happened to me is I have an older brother. And my older brother is the kind that says, I hate you and I'm never going to speak to you again, and he doesn't. He just doesn't. My brother has not talked to me in 22 years for a mistake that I made, that I have made amends for. And you know what? I envied him. If you're from the South, you know that it's terribly important to have backbone. Now, someplace along the line, I got being mean mixed up with being strong. And I envied mean people because they didn't seem to get hurt. And I hated myself because I laughed when nobody laughed, and I cried and I cared, and I hated that about me. And after I found my medicine, which for me was, I was with a bunch of kids, and it was a bottle of Slow Gin. And, I was 14. It was sweet and syrupy. You know, I mean, none of us knew how to mix drinks. Hell, I got a bottle, you know. And I had a warm quart of Coors with it. And I was with a bunch of kids up at a Lover's Lane type thing. And I had done with that like I had done all my life. I knew I was never going to have a boyfriend, so I didn't try. And they were all passing their bottles around, kissing each other and stuff like that. And I took my bottle of Slow Gin and my warm quart of Coors. And I went over to the edge of the cliff, and I drank that bottle of Slow Gin, and I chased it with that warm quart of Coors all by myself. And that's basically how I drank and used for the next 9 years. It was shortly thereafter that I was introduced to the wonderful world of drugs other than alcohol. And for me, it was a wonderful world, mainly because in that textbook, Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about, we only read a small portion at meetings, but one of the obsessions it talks about in there is that somehow, some way, we're going to beat this game. And when I found drugs other than alcohol, I really thought I had beat the game. I was going to be able to kill the way I felt inside, but I was not going to end up like them. And I really thought I had beat it. I do not identify as an alcoholic and an addict simply because I think it's redundant. It's like saying I'm an alcoholic and an alcoholic. It's I've never seen an addict that can drink socially over any considerable period of time, and I've never seen an alcoholic who can shoot dope successfully over a period of time. You know, I just never have. And I've watched. So, and I guess because I did get sober 13 years ago, and one of the things that a man said to me was, little lady, never forget, you need Alcoholics Anonymous. It doesn't need you. And those things, I was taught that it's an absolute privilege to attend a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, that they allow me the privilege of using their answer, and that what we have here is, what we share in common is the disease of alcoholism, and the way out is as outlined in the textbook. And I've never forgotten that, and I can identify absolutely with that. And I guess when I got sober, I didn't have the privilege or the luxury of my drug of choice, whatever that was. I had to learn to identify with the disease, and I believe it was my greatest blessing, because I don't think there's a single person in this room that if you say you're alcoholic, I can't identify with you. Be you straight, gay, I don't care what. I can identify with everyone based on what they taught me when I was new. Alcoholics Anonymous has grown, and it's wonderful. The face of Alcoholics Anonymous has changed in the last 7 years. And that's the good news. The bad news is sometimes we split off and we make ourselves different. And one of my major problems in life has been conscious separation from everything and everybody. And today, more than anything else, I ask God to relieve me of the obsession of self so that I can feel the common bond with everyone in Alcoholics Anonymous. And for that, I'm grateful. I'm grateful. Anyway, I was introduced to that, and I found my drug of choice, and which was heroin. And I made two brilliant decisions based on self when I found that. And that's number one, if I could just stay loaded till I died and never love anybody, everything would be all right. Because love and hurt too much. And that's the career I pursued for the next 9 years. Now, I'll never forget the first time I was in juvenile hall, because I had never known anybody that had been in juvenile hall. I went to school outside of Tulsa at Sacred Heart Academy. I love it. You know, I went to ninth grade in Sacred Heart Academy, 10th grade juvenile hall, 11th grade Isabel Buckley Schools in Los Angeles, and graduated in Youth Authority. Do you think I had a problem? You know, I was probably one of the most well-spoken heroin addicts in Youth Authority. However, I pursued that career, and I remember the first time I went in juvenile hall, and you know, I was absolutely terrified. I had never known anyone that had been in juvenile hall. I was the only kid in juvenile hall that said yes, ma'am, to the counselors, and I found out that's not the way you conduct yourself very quickly. I learned to cuss, and I learned to be tough, because I didn't ever want to hurt again as long as I lived. And my drinking and using career was very simple. It was 6 months on the street, 6 months locked up, in and out and in and out. You know, another thing that textbook states is that the alcoholic will reach a point where he cannot differentiate the true from the false, and his alcoholic life becomes the only normal one. And that's what happened to me, because I remember being terrified that first time I went to juvenile hall, and I also remember in the end that I always kept a few miscellaneous warrants out so that I could go home if I ever got tired. It became normal to me to hate everyone and see them as the enemy. It became normal to me to compromise myself to a point that I did not know any longer that it was compromise. I thought it was choice. It became normal to me to live in terror. It became normal to me to be sick. It became normal to me to live like an animal with no human values. It became normal to me to do all of that. The first time that I began to seek help was shortly before my 18th birthday, and that's obviously not yesterday. Yeah, it's about 18 years ago. And there wasn't any place for people like me. There wasn't any place at all. And so I ended up in Synanon because it was the only place there was. Now, Synanon was a wonderful experience for me. However, they didn't teach me anything about the disease I have or the insanity that comes. And of course, the insanity came and I left. And I was worse than I ever was before. And it was shortly thereafter that I attended my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And I have to tell you that from the first time that I attended my Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, I wanted what you people had. From the very first time, didn't know what it was, but wanted it. In fact, I wanted to be sober more 18 years ago than I did 13 years ago. 13 years ago, I didn't care anymore. I just didn't care. I had shot my best shot, and I just couldn't have it, and I didn't know why. But 18 years ago, when I attended my first Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, they told me I could stay sober, and I believed them. And you know what? I couldn't. I'd be sober for a little while, and I'd end up loaded, and I didn't know why. I absolutely did not know why. It seemed like everybody in AA knew why I couldn't stay sober but me. Everybody. I remember this guy, Joe Haley, that he was an old timer, and he walked up to me in a meeting. He said, "You know, little lady, you're your problem." And I thought, no shit. You know, it's like, now what? Okay, let's go from there. I was a giant of mental health when at 10 years sober, I got well enough to realize that the big book talks about that some of you were wrong too. I miss that. I sit in meetings where people say we don't take the other person's inventory, and I wonder, do they read a different textbook than I do? Because Bill Wilson just took Mr. Brown's inventory all over the place, and it was real petty. I mean, you know, it was just real petty. And after that little drawing, you know, where he's been like flirting with his wife and all that stuff, and they go through all those things that Mr. Brown and then the broad that's damaged his reputation told his wife about his mistress, all that. After you get through that, when you get down at the bottom there, it makes a tremendous statement, which I swear to you I did not see till I was 10 years sober. It says, the first thing apparent, not the third or the fourth, it says, the first thing apparent is that this world and its people were often quite wrong. I never saw that. Now I've learned that first I take your inventory, then I look for where I was wrong, and then I look for my fears, and then later on I write about sex. However, at that point I didn't have the knowledge of that. I was just a pathetic little girl who wanted to be sober and didn't know what it was all about. And that began a journey for me in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous that lasted 5 years. And I've never forgotten what it's like to be a loser in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it's a terrible thing to be a loser amongst losers. It's a terrible thing when the losers look down on you. It's a terrible thing. It's amazing to me when I sit in meetings and someone will come up to me and say, "Marie, that man's been drinking." And I think, well, no shit, this is AA, you know? I mean, it's like, you know, there's such a thing as called a relapse. And like the textbook says, although continued abstinence is certainly by far what we would like to see everyone have, that sometimes a relapse lays the groundwork to freedom that's necessary. And that's what happened in my case. However, there were many groundworks to freedom. Anyway, I had nowhere else to go, so I drank and used for a little while, and I'd end up in another Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And each time I came back, I had a little bit more demoralization, a little bit more despair, and I didn't understand. And I would be here for a while, and I would go again, and I didn't understand. And I felt alienated even here. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what I hope was my last drunk, which I can do today without crying Gracie. I used to, the first time that I ever spoke in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 4.5 years sober, and it was a group about half the size of this room, and the next group I spoke at was the Palm Springs Roundup. And I had never been to a convention, I had never seen that many people, and they were all dressed up. And I was to tell my story, and I cried all the way through it. I cried because it was frightening. It was one thing to read the textbook when it said, cling to the thought that in God's hands your darkest past will become the greatest treasure you possess. With it, you'll avert death and suffering for others. It was one thing to be in my own home and read, burn the idea into the consciousness of every man that he can get well, regardless of anyone. And to me, that meant the people in AA. The only conditions are you trust in God and clean house. It's another thing to be on a stage in front of 3,000 drunks that are all dressed up and tell them about it. But I'll tell you why I tell where I came from, and I don't particularly like revisiting the grave. But by the time I was rendered sober 13 years ago, and I say rendered because I had no idea that I was going to be sober. I did not try. I can't even take credit for the willingness, because I didn't put the willingness there. You know, I was rendered sober 13 years ago. And when I was, you see, I had reached a point where I was afraid that I was too dirty for Alcoholics Anonymous. That the bottom that I had hit, that no matter how many showers I ever took, no matter what I ever did, I would never be able to wash that filth off of me. That even if I was able to stay sober, I could never be like you guys. Because I could just never get over what had happened. I felt so filthy. And I swore that if I was ever able to stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I would stand up someday with all the dignity that I had and tell where I came from. Because you see, by the time I got sober, the ladies in Alcoholics Anonymous had cleaned up their talk so much that I thought I was the only one. You see? They would, and Patty and I are in agreement. You know, sometimes I listen to women speakers in AA, and when they finish, I think to myself, but did they drink? You know, it's like, no, it's like, they, I know about their feelings, I know about their children, I know, you know, but did they drink? Did their disease own them the way mine eventually owned me? You see, they told me in Alcoholics Anonymous that if I had continued to drink, I would go places I had never been before. And I couldn't imagine where I was going to go. I had a worse story at 21 than most of these people had at 60. But it had become a normal way of life for me. But I'll tell you where I went inside on that last run. I went points of demoralization and degradation and despair that I did not know humanly possible. I reached points of self-loathing and desperation because drugs and alcohol were not working for me. They hadn't worked for me in a long time, and the only reason I was living that way was because I couldn't have this, and I didn't know why. Quite simply, where I ended up was I ended up a very cheap $10 whore walking the streets of Hollywood in an absolute state of shock that I ended up like that. Because you see, other women end up like that, not women like me. Women less bright, less pretty, less something, but not me, because I was going to stop. It wasn't, and I had been to AA long enough to know nothing but my disease had taken me there. Absolutely nothing but my, I hear in meetings a lot about self-esteem and stuff like that, and I want you to know in the last 13 years, I have had self-esteem lower than a snake's belly, and I have never turned a $10 trick, you know. My disease took me there, and I hated myself. I hated myself and the world, and it was so ugly. And I might also add, I only did that for 2 months, but it absolutely broke me. It absolutely broke me. And what started happening was I waited for them to come and get me, whoever they were, because I couldn't do it anymore. And I started trying to kill myself. And you're looking at somebody who's been dead on arrival 3 times. I believe that there are 2 kinds of recoveries for the alcoholic, death and sobriety. And I had to make peace with that when I was 2 years sober, when my Aunt Jo died. Because she was the person that if I could have given this gift to, of anybody in the world, I would have given it to her. And what I knew from that, that either there is a loving God, either God is all merciful and all loving, or he's not. And that I believe sometimes with this disease, what I know about my Aunt Jo, if there had been a recovery for her, she would be alive today. I believe her death to be merciful. For some reason, I didn't die. And my reaction to not dying was to wake up in hospital rooms and say, oh shit, because I had to do it over again. What started happening to me quite simply was I'd been around Alcoholics Anonymous long enough to hear about this thing called a higher power. And I got to thinking nobody died without God's permission, because I had been trying. And it seemed like other people just kind of went over in the corner and died. And people kept telling me, Murray, if you keep living like this, you're going to die someday. And I thought, when? You know, it was like life had always been an overrated PR job to me. Many years into sobriety, at least many years for my little 13 years, the majority of it, the only reason I was alive was because I didn't die. It was not any thrill for living. And I might also add that that gift has finally been given to me in the last 3 years. An absolute thrill. I mean, do you realize I can hardly sleep at night? I wake up at 1 o'clock. I go to sleep at 1 o'clock in the morning, and I can't sleep past six. Because I'm just so excited about what's going to happen that day. Win, lose, or draw, I'm out there batting. And that took a lot of years for me in AA. But anyway, that's the way I ended up. And what happened for me was I got to thinking nobody died without God's permission. So I got down on my knees and I went to this God that I didn't understand. However, my grandmother had told me that he could see and hear and knew everything you were doing. Okay, see, I didn't know a lot about God, but I knew, okay? And I went to this God, and I believe I said for me what was the first naked prayer I'd ever said in my life. I've also done that about three times since I've been sober. And every time I do that, my whole universe changes. Those incredible prayers. And that night, there was absolutely nothing between me and me anymore. It had been beat out of me. I was as desperate as a human being could be, and I wasn't even desperate anymore. It just didn't matter. And I went to this God that I didn't understand, and I said, God, I don't know what's wrong with me. I have tried everything. I've been in Synanon, I've been in private therapy, I've been in group therapy, I've been to Alcoholics Anonymous. They sent me to Narcotics Anonymous. The people in NA said I needed the women in AA, and I went back there. I've had the help of the greatest people. And I cannot make it, and would you let me go soon? Now, I had dying in mind. And what happened to me through a very strange series of events was I ended up in another Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, of which I did not take myself to. And you would think that I would be thrilled, but I wasn't, because you see, it didn't work for me. And I knew it was my problem. I knew there was something wrong with me. I didn't know what it was. And two very important things were said to me. A gal named Jerry, who was kind enough to 13-step me, said, listen, she's still sober, so am I. It kept the men away from me. And I didn't know, I'll tell you something, I didn't know when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that I could say no to a man to go to bed with him. I thought I either had to go to bed with him or leave, and I was just always leaving, you know. And so, anyway, Jerry said to me, you know, Murray, because my name back then was Murray. Only because I sold drugs. Okay. I have always been terribly foo-foo like this, but... She said to me, you know, Murray, you can't stay sober. And I was so relieved somebody knew. Because ever since I had been coming to AA, they told me, you can stay sober, you can stay sober. And I couldn't. And she said, you can't stay sober. And she said, you're going to have to find a God of your very own that will keep you sober no matter what. Now, what that meant to me is by then I had amassed 17 felonies in the court that I had jumped bail on all of them. I no longer owned a pair of shoes because my friends had ripped me off while I was in the hospital.
I had also lost my mind, and I didn't know why. I had been very bright when I was young, but I couldn't think anymore. And I had always had being sober mixed up with being good. And what that meant to me was that I would have to find a God of my very own that would keep me sober in the penitentiary, and also find a God that would keep me sober whether I was ever a lady or not, because I had totally given up hope of ever being a lady, whatever that was. And the other thing that was said to me was by a guy named Danny, and he walked up to me. He said, "Marie, you probably know more about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous than anyone I know. Now you're just going to have to do it." And what he said to me that night was, and what I got, is that there is no way to stay sober but to stay sober. Now, I know some of you get that at your first meeting, you know? But I missed the trip. I oftentimes wondered why I went in and out for all those years, and now I know. I just missed the trip. I sat in the same meetings, but what I have to tell you, especially if you're a slipper, is that I never lived in the conscious awareness of a living, vibrant Alcoholics Anonymous that I have lived in the last 13 years, all those years going in and out. I just missed the trip. I just missed it. Anyway, basically what I got that night and what I have to share with members of Alcoholics Anonymous, whether you're new or you've been here for a while and your insanity's on you, is that you come in here, you get your cup of coffee, and you take your chair, and you don't ever let anybody take it from you, most of all you. You see, 13 years ago when I got sober, I didn't know if I was straight or gay. I had made my living as a prostitute. I was a heroin addict, and I was exceptionally pretty. Now, any one of those things was enough to make the people around me in AA nervous. However, I had them all. And I think that that is my greatest blessing, because I was not able to belong to social circles, and I was one of the throwaways, so what I was left with was what they put in my hand, and it was called a textbook. You see, in my home group, the biggest you ever get in Alcoholics Anonymous is to know the textbook and love God. That's as high as you ever go in my group. There's as much social pressure in my home group to attend the book study as there is some of the fancier speaker meetings. If I had thought for a moment, I don't know that I could get sober at some of the meetings that they asked me to speak at in Alcoholics Anonymous today because of the social pressure. If I had thought for one moment that anyone was looking at what I was wearing, I would have been dead. Because you see, I only had a pair of blue jeans, and I very promptly put on 50 or 60 pounds. And I wasn't a pretty sight. You got me wearing a rib brace, and this side of my face was black from a beating. And those people in that group used to tell me how pretty I was. And you know what? I believed them. I believed them. And I look back now, and I wasn't. But they told me that. Because they saw something inside of me that I did not see and had long since given up on. I got sober in a very sick, low-bottom group, and I'll be forever grateful those people were as sick as they were, because they were just sick enough to believe that the power laid out in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous could take that pathetic little girl, no matter how long she had been losing, and create a miracle in her life and stand her up. Actually, this is beyond my wildest dreams, to be a human. But they believed that I could be sober. And they gave me that textbook, and they fed me, and they clothed me. And what I did was I started getting up in the morning, and I went to this God that I didn't understand. And I said, God, I would have much preferred dying. However, if you're going to keep me alive, for God's sakes, keep me sober, because I can't drink and love. And I'd go to bed at night and I'd say, thanks. And that was it. I was at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings in between. And that's the only thing I changed. And you know what? Since studying that textbook, I realized that's the basis of our whole program, that we can't do it. And collectively, there was a power in these rooms that lifts us from our madness. I am very privileged, I believe, to be one of those members of Alcoholics Anonymous who has never lost the awe of physical sobriety. I think the greatest miracle that's ever going to happen to me in life happened to me 13 years ago. Because I don't know about you, but my drugs and alcohol owned me. Absolutely owned me. I could do well for a while. I could build my self-esteem. I could get jobs. I could get healthy. I could get a lover. I could have all the breaks in life. But the one thing I could not do for myself over any considerable period of time was to lift that merciless obsession, the insanity that precedes the first drink, where after a period of time, having been sober, I would reach and I would hit those peculiar blank spots where I could not recall the suffering of a month or 6 months or 6 weeks ago, and some insane trivial idea would come to me and it would make sense. Or worse than that, I wouldn't think at all. Or having been sober for a while, I would feel myself, you know, I hear in meetings people talk about, I didn't slip, I made a decision to get drunk. What the textbook states about that is it calls it a slip. It says that anyone having been sober for a period of time who makes the decision to drink, feeling themselves justified by self-pity, resentment, or the like, in lieu of past circumstances of what's happened in the past, it says this person must be insane to make a decision like that. And I didn't understand the insanity that preceded the first drink. It's the one spring. It's the one trap I could never spring for myself. I told you how they got me, and that's what I did. I just... And something very strange started happening. All my life, there have been two kinds of people. The good people and me. And the good people were the people that got the breaks, or magic just seemed to happen in their lives. And I was real tired 13 years ago. The war was over and I had lost. Wasn't any big sobriety deal, just the war was over. I was tired. I came in and I got my cup of coffee. I sat with the old people and I've been too tired to leave ever since. You know, I lost the war. I lost it, you know. And I started, like I said, getting up in the morning asking God to keep me sober. And I was at AA meetings in between and something very strange started happening. And that was coincidences started happening. Like, I would be sitting at my home group because I didn't have a dollar to my name. Nothing. And someone in my home group would walk by and say, Marie, I'm going to dinner and I need some company. Would you please come with me? And I would be so hungry. And I'd go with them. And little strange things began to happen. And I got... The day started passing and I was sober. And I got that maybe if this higher power could do that, maybe it could do other things. And I am very, very grateful for the bottom I hit. Because what I know is that my Heavenly Father can provide all of my needs. From sex to money to food to clothes to everything. And I learned, and those strange coincidences started happening. It was hard for me to be sober. I didn't understand anything they talked about in meetings, and I tried desperately. I would go to step study meetings, and they'd be like on the sixth step. And it wasn't a matter of not being able to do it. I would sit in those meetings, and I would start to hyperventilate because I couldn't even understand what they were talking about, let alone do it. And I was desperately frightened that my dishonesty was going to get me drunk before I was able to understand the type of honesty they were talking about. And I would sit in these meetings and I would get so nervous, and then towards the end of the meeting somebody would say, and remember, don't drink. And I'd go, because that's like all I could get, and all I could understand was the ABCs. And my sponsor told me to read the big book. I have to tell you, I remembered something the other night, and it's a very important event in my life. I slept on people's floors for 8 months. And I had less money sober than I had had loaded. And I had never been through that. And I used to say to myself, Murray, if you live like this now, you may never have to live like this again. And everybody got well quicker than I did. everybody had apartments and everybody had cars and all of those things. And I used to die because I would watch them and I tried to be grateful for sobriety. And when I was 8 months sober, I was at my grandmother's house. And the phone rang one day. And a lady from Alcoholics Anonymous said to me on the phone, "Marie, have you ever thought about having a place of your own?" And I said, "Cheryl, that's a dream." And she said, "Well, I know where there's one for $70 a month with furnished and utilities." And I said to her, "You know what, Cheryl? $70 or $1,000. I don't have any money, and I don't have one more cute smile to get it." And she said, "Baby, why don't you move in, because I've already rented it for you." And I said, "Can I hang up?" And I just clicked down the phone. And I cried like a baby that day, because it was the first time in my life that I knew that God loved Marie Stenner, that I was one of the other people. Slowly but surely, that started happening in my life. And I wanted more than any. I was afraid to hope that the magic was working, the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, there's a lady here this weekend, and you guys are real privileged. I hope I don't embarrass you. Lou Ann Sims was one of the few speakers I heard when I was new. And I loved her because she always talked to newcomers. She always talked to newcomers, and she told me we didn't have to drink. And you see, I didn't understand anything else. But somehow, when I would hear her, she kept it very, very simple, and I believed her. I believed her, and there were very few people in AA that I believed. They told me in my home group, "Here, we speak the language of the heart," and I believed her. And I was, when I saw you tonight, I thought about those times. So many years ago that I sat in rooms and was afraid to hope against hope. I want to tell you a little bit about my first birthday, because for me it's very important. I had been sober for a year, and at last the day had arrived. You know, my sponsor had I went to my sponsor one time and I said, "Cheryl, what's a winner?" Because I didn't know. I had seen people talk good and they got loaded. I had seen people who had money and they got loaded. I saw all this different stuff. And I said, "What's a winner?" And she looked at me and she said, "Baby, a winner's a loser who never stops trying." And I knew that I would never be a winner in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I also knew that I'd die trying. And at last the day had arrived, and now these people had fed me and clothed me at my home group, and I just knew nobody was going to care. The self-centeredness of the alcoholic. So I told them my birthday was on Tuesday, and it was really on Monday, or the day we had picked. And so I went to a group in Hollywood called Gramercy. And at Gramercy, they have big round wooden tables. And I walked in that group, and I'll never forget it. One of those tables was all covered with cards and gifts and flowers, and they were all for me. I had never been the kind of person that people gave flowers to. Flowers were for nice ladies. Flowers were for the nice people in the world. And I sat down in that room, and it occurred to me that at last the day had arrived. But it occurred to me I was going to have to get up there and say something. And I thought, "Oh my God, what am I going to say? I'm so sick. I don't have any of the things that you're supposed to have in Alcoholics Anonymous so that you give newcomers hope. I'm so sick. What am I going to say?" And it was as if my Heavenly Father spoke to me, because it occurred to me that no matter how sick I knew I was, there were new women in that room that night. They were sitting on the edge of their chair just like I had been all year. And that no matter how sick I was, I had been gifted with 356 days back, or 52, I don't know what a year is. What is it, Tara? What is the year? 365. Well, you know what, when I took a cake my first year at Los Feliz, and I told them that if, I was so nervous, I said, if you don't take, all I know about this program is that if you don't pick up a drink fixer pill for 365 years, you'll get a cake with a candle on it. And they all started laughing, and I didn't know why. So, but anyway, I had 365 days, freedom. Absolute freedom from the bottle. And then no matter how sick I knew I was, to those new women, I was well. And they would give their right arm to have what I had. And I started to sob because it was the first time in my life I had ever been an example of anything good. And I could not believe. And that's the day I joined you guys. That's the day I became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's the reason I'm here tonight. It is absolutely the reason I'm here tonight. I have never forgotten what it was like to be owned by my disease. And my life changed drastically after that. For one, I turned myself into the police, which was, I had made a deal with my God. Now I understand other people's deals with God don't work, and that's fine. But however, I made one, it worked real well. And I told God that if he'd leave me on the streets for 1 year so I could get this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, so that when I went to the penitentiary, I wouldn't have to come out and start all over again, that I would turn myself in. And I did that, and I went to trial for 6 months. And I was given a suspended 5 to life. And I stood in that courtroom, and the judge looked at me and said, Marie, this is the longest you have been, and by the way, I had no attorney. And he said, Marie, this is the longest you've been out of jail since you were 15. He said, this is one of the greatest credits to Alcoholics Anonymous I have ever seen come through my courtroom. And I started to sob, because one more time, maybe I had given back a little bit to AA. See, I don't have a family, except I've got one now, because my brother, who's down here, is 29, and he's been in Al-Anon, and he's gay. And we're raising my 9-year-old son together. But I had never, when you got me, I didn't have any family. I didn't have anything. And you raised me. And I watched the women in Alcoholics Anonymous because I so desperately wanted to carry this message. That's all I wanted in life. Other people wanted jobs. I just wanted to pay back Alcoholics Anonymous. And I watched them. I watched the way they dressed. And I would see the women come in with lipstick on and makeup, and they smelled like perfume. And what that meant to me was that they had it together enough to spend a few hours by themselves doing that, which I could not do. But I watched them, and they taught me, and I learned from them. And I learned how to dress. And you humanized me again. So much has happened in the last 13 years, I can't tell you. I remember standing in my living room. Number one, I have to tell you something. I was sitting with some newcomers. Newcomers really are interesting today in AA. And they were talking about their sexual fantasies and how they were getting them fulfilled sober. I mean, I guess that's part of the steps. Hell, I don't know. But, they were talking about it, and and I was sitting there, and I'll tell you something. For me in Alcoholics Anonymous, other than the freedom from the chains that drugs and alcohol had on me, my greatest freedom in Alcoholics Anonymous is that I have not had to sleep with somebody unless I desperately wanted to. I mean, how much in your life can you do that? You know? I made my living that way, and I did not want to do that anymore. So they were all talking about it, and they looked at me, because I was the old-timer in the group, And they said, well, Marie, you must have been, years in sobriety done it all. And I thought, nope. In fact, I had kind of become boring, if the truth's known. And Patty and I were talking about that tonight. You know, God, if we had an opportunity to do it, we probably wouldn't know how. I mean, it's like, love Alcoholics Anonymous, but don't know a lot about that anymore. But they said, Marie, you must have. And I looked at them and I said, no, I have not fulfilled my sexual fantasies sober. And it was like a light bulb went off in my head because it occurred to me, oh, yes, I had. I had one dream all my life. And that was someday that I could be decent. And you know what? Alcoholics Anonymous gave me that. Alcoholics Anonymous gave me that I don't have to sleep with people. Alcoholics Anonymous gave me a wedding that was absolutely incredible. And Alcoholics Anonymous gave me a son. Alcoholics Anonymous also gave me the dignity to walk through a divorce. Alcoholics Anonymous gave me the dignity to be a family member. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the dignity to be an employee. Alcoholics Anonymous has taken that pathetic little girl and put her in the world as a 36-year-old woman. And I can't even believe that. I can't even believe that. And what's exciting to me, I was plagued by depression for years. And I don't have depressions anymore. It got so bad sometimes during that first year that I just don't live like that anymore. And I'm very, very grateful. I'd like to tell you where I'm at today because it's real important to me. I walked through that divorce, and it was the first family I'd ever had in my life. My husband was my best friend. He was 20 years older than I was. And I lost the only family I'd ever known. And I was full of self-pity. The closest I ever came to drinking was 9.5 years sober. I'd never experienced the obsession to drink. And 9.5 years sober, I experienced it. And it was with me for 2 months, where every morning when I woke up, I was obsessed with the thought of drinking. What I found out is that self-pity and resentment by any other name is still self-pity and resentment. See, this is how not bright I was. You got me as a child. I thought self-pity was like if you felt sorry for yourself when you didn't have any reason. But if you had a reason, then it didn't. Well, no, I mean, and I had reasons. My husband had gotten drunk, and everybody in AA rushed in to take care of him, and I was hanging on by my bloody fingernails, and they looked at me and said, what are you going to do about that self-pity, Marie? And I started thinking, what do I have to do? To get drunk to be deserving of these people's love? You know, what do I have? I reached a point, I didn't want to be 9.5 years sober anymore. I envied newcomers, and I felt like this thing, like the big book says, that this thing, life, didn't pay off. I had shot my best shot in Alcoholics Anonymous. And people that didn't know a 12-step called, they hit them in the face, were getting laid, and they had money, and they had everything. And I had nothing, and I was full of self-pity. Absolutely full of self-pity. And I went back to my home group, and I wrote another inventory. You know, my life today is absolutely incredible. I surrendered custody of that little boy. I slept on people's floors again. I'm very grateful to report that the steps worked just as well at 9.5 years and 13 years as they did when I was newly sober. I walked through that darkness, and where I'm at today was, I was at the Palm Springs Roundup last year, and I left that roundup, and the day after I left that roundup, my little boy was dropped off on my doorstep to live. And a month later, my brother, my baby, see, we were from an alcoholic home, and Terrell was my baby. I dressed him in dresses. I took care of him. And he was my baby, and I raised him, and he was living in Houston, and I used to beg him to come home. and I had lost that family, and Terrell arrived home, and I had a little bitty one-bedroom house, and I didn't know how we were going to do it, and I screamed and yelled a lot, and thank God he was in Al-Anon. And our life today is absolutely incredible. We live in a family that's recovering. And that's what I want to share with you most of all, that another lifetime dream has come true for me. I always wanted a healthy family. And our life is absolutely incredible. When I went through all that self-pity, I used to watch these women I had always hated in AA. One of them's Alabama Carruthers, who's my sponsor, because she's always, I'm so cheerful. And this lady named Jane Gray, who was just, I swear the woman had brain damage. She didn't have sense enough to get resentments or something. I don't know. Because she was always cheerful, you know, and walking up to newcomers saying, hey, you know. And I just wasn't a real social animal. I was very grateful to God that I didn't want too much to do with his kids, you know. And what I started doing was, it occurred to me that possibly my the way I lived and my actions towards people was a defect of character. And so I started praying on a daily basis for a cheerful heart and an energetic soul. Now, I know that sounds corny, but I prayed. That's my prayer today, is that I want a cheerful heart and an energetic soul. And I have become one of the most energetic people I know. I don't know what it is I do, but I do a whole hell of a lot of it from 6 a.m. to 1 a.m., you know. We've got that little boy's in karate. Uncle Terrell's had, it's been interesting for Terrell to go from West Hollywood to Houston to being an uncle. And we live in that little house. And recently I was able at my work, where they call me Miss Dinner, I had to work 30 days straight, long hours. And my brother took care of my son. And they just did it great. They did it real great. And so when you guys asked me to come here, I was able, and I owe this all to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I was useless all my life. I was able to say to him, baby, come with me, and buy his airplane ticket so that we could come here and be with you guys. And I'm just so glad. And you know, when I called Jack and I said, Jack, can I come? And Jack said, yeah, you know. And I was so grateful. And my greatest thrill today is just giving it back. You know, if I spend the rest of my life coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, giving it back, I'll never, ever be able to clean the slate, not as long as I live. One thing that I was able to find out from 5 to 10 years is that God is not the problem. I spent the first 5 years in AA being introduced to the fact that there was a God and he had a better life for me here in AA. I spent the next 5 years living in and finding out what it was about me that kept me from having it. And that my job is to get empty of self, and I'm automatically filled with God. So I spend a whole lot of time cleaning my house of resentment, fear, and most of all resentment at myself. The book calls it remorse. Says when we turned it in on ourselves, it was worse. So I make those lists, and I ask God to remove those defects of character, and God does, in fact, remove them. And I ask him to turn my eyeballs outward to what he would have me be, and to relieve me of the bondage of self, that I can be an example of his mercy and the love that you guys have given me. And I think that's all I have to say. Thank you.
For additional copies of this recording, please contact B&B Tapes at area code 972-317-1020. That's 972-317-1020. Or write B&B Tapes, Post Office Box 1250, Louisville, Texas 75067. Thank you.